I'm Joe Wood, and I believe.
December 9, 1965. An incident some would later call Pennsylvania's Roswell happens. Numerous people in several U.S. states and Canadian provinces report a fireball blazing across the sky. Further related reports told of hot metal debris scattered over Michigan and Ohio. In Kettsburg, Pennsylvania, residents report that an object crashed in neighboring woods. They describe it was shaped like an acorn, bearing symbols that look like hieroglyphics. U.S. military arrives at the site, recovers the object, and takes it away. John Hayes, a 10-year-old at the time, later told NBC host Brian Gumbel he saw a flatbed truck emerging from the site, carrying something the size of a VW Beetle. What the object was, or where it came from, was never disclosed. NASA has since lost the records.
Welcome to Alien Nation, the ongoing series about extraterrestrials and UFOs, which asks the question, are we alone? I'll be talking to celebrities and everyday people who also believe and have their own incredible stories to share. We'll talk about well-documented cases, we'll examine the theories and the counter-theories, but mostly we'll just share our own personal experiences together. So get in touch with your own stories. I'll tell you how to do that at the end of the show. My guest today is the editor of UFO Truth magazine and leading expert on the Rendlesham incident. Welcome, Gary Heseltine. Nice to speak to you again.
Yes, lovely to speak to you again.
It was good to meet you at the UFO awakening. That was great. I loved it.
Yeah, Awakenings is, I don't class it as a UFO conference, although there are some lectures. It's too big for that. It's more of an entertainment weekend with lots of stalls and exhibits, etc. So it's a little bit different, but it's worked well, and I think it's now third or fourth year now.
Yeah, I found it really interesting. The first thing I've ever done like that, actually. Now, before you became interested in UFOs, you were a detective constable, weren't you?
Well, yes, but I had a sighting when I was 16 years old.
Oh.
That's what kicked off my interest.
Yeah.
And obviously that was while I was still at school or just leaving school. And I then went away, had a life, got married, had kids, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I was in the Royal Air Force Police for 6 years.
Oh, you were?
Yes, so I did 6 years in the Royal Air Force Police, which is interesting because when we talk about the Rendlesham Forest incident, which we'll talk about later in the film that I'm involved in, I did the same job. I guarded nuclear weapons for three of my 6 years service. I guarded nuclear weapons at two nuclear weapons bases, one in the UK and one in what was then West Germany. So I have a bit of a unique insight into how those military bases worked. And so when the Rendlesham event involves military police, US military police, doing the same job, I knew there must be a lot more witnesses.
Oh, that's fantastic. Oh, that's interesting. So then you were a policeman and a constable, and then you decided that you were going to concentrate on UFOs? Or did something happen to really push you into it?
A strange series of events, in reality, took place over a couple of years that led me to going public and creating the police database, which launched in January of 2002. Cutting a long story short, basically, I'd followed the subject for a long time. Obviously, having had a childhood sighting, I read all the books I could find at the time. Then away, went away, had a life, couple of kids kind of thing,
yeah.
Air Force, joined the police, that kind of thing. And then in about the mid-1990s, I came across a glossy magazine in W.H. Smith's on Leeds City Railway Station. And it was called UFO Magazine, and it was a printed A4 glossy magazine. And that kind of reawakened my interest. So after a couple of years of catching up on that, getting a few more books, reacquainting myself with the subject, a strange thing kind of happened. without any kind of prompting, I woke up from a very vivid dream, and it was so vivid, and I don't usually remember my dreams. I woke up from a very vivid dream with a set of characters and a premise for a Hollywood blockbuster on what could cause UFO disclosure.
It was
that vivid, and I kind of like had never written anything in my life whatsoever at that point, but I felt so compelled that within 6 weeks I had written a screenplay with no knowledge of how to write formatted screenplays at that time, a beginning, middle, and an end. And from that I then sent it to the editor of that magazine that I come across, and I wanted some kind of validation. And he said it was great and it would make a great film. And from that, he invited me to go to his three-day conference, which was held in Leeds. Well, we talk about strange coincidences in this field. Well, where did I work? Leeds.
Oh my gosh.
In Edinburgh, it could have been anywhere. But it was right on my doorstep. So he held this annual conference that lasted, I think, for 21 years until he died suddenly in 2003. But he invited me there, and I went, and I heard all these international famous UFO experts, and I felt myself being drawn in. It's obviously stimulated me, but it drew me back in. And then a strange thing happened again, probably about a year later, when I had a second vivid dream.
Yeah.
And again, don't usually remember dreams. But my second vivid dream was to create a police unofficial database for UK-based police officers to report UFOs. And I came up with the title Police Reporting UFOs. The acronym being PRUFOS. So I went to the editor of that magazine, a guy called Graham Birtle, and said, I've had this idea for this database. Will you allow me to write an article in your printed magazine to launch it? And he went, yeah, it sounds great. And he was always looking for very credible people. And he obviously looked at me as a detective at that time, police officer, as a credible person. And so he said, yeah, write your magazine, write an article. So that was a massive thrill for me because I'd never written anything, and this was going to be in the high street and in every news agent across the country. So I did that, and that created and launched the database in January 2002. And that is how I became known initially within the UFO field, because I didn't. And one of the things that was strange is I'd never anticipated what would happen. And what happened was UFO groups around the country in the UK began to say, oh, will you come and give us a lecture about your police cases that had began to amass? And I never thought of that at all, and I should have. But anyway, I then found myself being invited all around the country to do these lectures. Now, I'd never done any lectures. I'd always been a confident speaker, but there's a big difference between standing up in front of a few hundred people, and most of my colleagues would run a mile rather than stand in front of a few hundred people. But I found myself that it came actually very, very easy. In fact, so comfortable that I actually loved doing it. And that's always been the same since. So I found myself as this spin-off of giving lectures around the country. And obviously over the years, that then with time developed into international lectures, and I've now been all around the world doing that.
That is amazing. What a great story. I love that.
If anybody could have said to me that in your mid-20s, you're suddenly going to find yourself in your mid-40s going all around the world, I'd have laughed at them because it was so implausible. Yeah. But that's in reality what's happened.
So tell me something. Are there lots of sightings that police report?
Well, put it this way. When I began in January 2002, I had 6 historical cases that were known in UFO books and had been reported, involving around 10 British police officers, all very old cases, but had said 3 people attended, 2 people attended. So about 10 police officers. As we speak now, and I don't do as much work now because of the magazine, it gets in the way, but when I was really active with the police research, I now have figures of around 550 British police cases.
You're kidding.
Oh, yeah, unbelievably, going back to 1901, involving over 1,100 British police officers.
That's amazing. That is really amazing.
It is, and the national media aren't the slightest bit interested in those numbers.
Why is that?
Because there is a cover-up on the reality of this subject.
Yeah, there certainly is, isn't there?
It doesn't make sense. If you were, for example, year on year, the figures would go up and I would publish an annual report of the latest figures. And at first, I did attract a lot of national media attention, a lot of radio, TV, things like that. But after a year or so, as the numbers went up, and literally it was maybe 100 police officers per year.
Jesus.
The more it went up, the less the national media were interested. Now, if I'd have been a local golfer making good in your county, you'd get a lot of regional attention. And then if you'd gone to the national stage, international competition, you'd make a lot of attention, but not in this subject.
It's mad, isn't it?
It's crazy.
That you'd get more and more people reporting sightings and less they want to let everybody know about it.
And I tried to get mainstream publishers to publish the book. They're not interested one iota.
What did the superiors in the police force think about that then?
Initially, when I began, I told them exactly what I was doing. I'd set up a website and I was creating this database. Initially, they basically said, OK, it's your private hobby. Do whatever you want. But as time went on and more successful that I became, or the numbers increased, they began to say, well, we don't want you saying what rank you are. We don't want saying what your collar number is. We don't want to say where you're based. And I said, well, how can you do all this? Because I've already done that. The genie is out of the bottle. Yeah. But they tried to put the genie back in, but they couldn't. But in the end, I got disciplined, believe it or not, just for letting the other chief constables all around Britain and know that the Ministry of Defence had suddenly closed its MOD reporting facility that had existed for 50 years. They suddenly closed it in December 2009. So I thought, oh, what are they going to do with all these people who still report things? They've got to treat them professionally. What are they going to do with this information? So I basically wrote to all the chief constables in England, Scotland and Wales and said, you might not be aware of this because it's a strange subject, but this has happened. You're still going to get people ringing up saying, I've seen something. You're going to have to treat them professionally. Would you give them my details? And so that they can contact me and so at least we'll not lose those sightings. Yeah. And initially, of the 38 police forces that I contacted, within 2 weeks, 24 of them had come back and said, thank you for bringing this to our attention. And I'd said that I was doing it in an off-duty capacity. This was a private venture. I mentioned which force I belonged to, blah, blah, blah. And they basically, two of the forces said, we'll adopt you straight away as our single point of contact, a SPOC as it's called, ironically. Oh. And that was Humberside, my own force, where I was born in Scunthorpe, in what is now Lincolnshire, but then Humberside and Suffolk, which is coincidentally the home of the Rendlesham Forest incident. They immediately said, yeah, you'll be our point of contact. We get any sight and we'll send them to you. And I thought, great. However, I was just about to go on a course when I got summoned to the office of the chief superintendent, my chief superintendent, and he said, you wrote to the MOD? And I said, yeah, in an off-duty capacity. I disclosed everything and whatever. And he said, well, we've got a new chief constable now, and he's took a very dim view of what you've done. And I said, well, you can't put the genie back in the bottle 9 years after the event of me coming out, as it were. And he said, well, he's instructed me to instigate misconduct hearings into you, which could lead to your job getting sacked.
You're kidding.
So I was then investigated for a year. In the end, I then got a 12-month written warning just for writing to the MOD and other police forces. So that kind of told me that the writing was on the wall. If they wanted to make things difficult, and I think anybody who has been a part of a big organisation, if that big organisation begins to turn against you in some way, they can find ways to do it. Yeah. So that was one of the reasons that made me contemplate retiring early. And so I retired in 2013, 6 years early, after 24 years, to launch UFO Truth magazine, which is arguably the best decision I've ever made.
Isn't that amazing? I just can't believe that.
Even better story to do with the police and senior officers.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, you bet.
Now, after 24 years, the same chief superintendent, who I'd always got on well with, and he'd always got on well with me, never a problem. I had a lot of respect for him. When you leave the police, it's customary that you have like a final interview with your area commander, or chief super, the boss in your area. So I had mine, and I kind of thought that he might bring up the UFO issue. So unbeknownst to him, I recorded the interview silently without his knowledge as I walked into the room in my suit. I had my phone recording in case he mentioned UFOs.
Yeah.
And guess what? He did. And this is the same guy who was instructed to institute disciplinary proceedings against me. But do you know what he told me?
What?
And it will be in the book at some point.
Yeah.
He said to me, oh, when I was younger, I had a UFO sighting on duty as well.
He did?
He did, and I've still got the audio recording. And he then said, oh, my colleague did as well, a female officer. Now, I couldn't help the irony there. I didn't know he was going to say it, but I just got an inkling that he would say something, and he did, but I didn't expect him to say that. But how ironic that he could discipline me, and yet he couldn't speak up against the chief constable and say, well, actually, sir, these things are pretty real. I saw one too, and my colleague did.
He's afraid. I mean, I don't know what he's afraid of. Speaking the truth, I don't understand it. Must be the bigger guys that know about it all and hushing them all up.
Yeah, I think that is the reality. I think the vast majority of police officers, even chief constables, know very little about it, as do most, as do not most politicians, most military people. There is only a handful of people who know the reality of what's going on, but it's very real, and it's very easy to demonstrate that things that should make the 6 o'clock news don't.
Yeah, they don't, do they? You never hear anything like that, because I think, you know, I spoke to Kathleen Marden, and she said,
lovely lady, Kathleen,
she said that, because I asked her why she thought they didn't, the governments didn't say anything. She said, well, it will upset people. People will freak out too much. And I think that is the reality of it.
I personally don't agree with that now. I think maybe Cold War era, after the Second World War, there was a lot of tension. People were very frightened. I think there was a good reason to keep UFO ET reality away from the public at that time. It was a very unstable time.
Yeah.
But I think after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that was the time when the Americans, who dominate this subject historically from the 1940s at least, worldwide, is when they should have disclosed, actually, we do know a lot more, and now the world has changed and it's hopefully a safer place. Now we can tell you what's going on. But the recent Pentagon admissions from December 16th, 2017, were a revelation for those people who aren't aware. On December the 16th, 2017, the Pentagon admitted that objects, mechanical objects, are flying around in the US airspace at speeds and maneuverability way beyond anything that America possesses. Now, they stopped short of saying it was extraterrestrial because they're frightened of using that word. They want to kind of just say, well, these things exist. But that was a very important admission, because from that point on, the press, who would always, the mainstream, had always ridiculed us, could never say that again. Because they'd actually admitted these things are flying around. They don't know what they are. They don't know where they're from. They don't know the technology. Now, that says a lot. And when you listen to the Navy pilots, the military pilots who got involved in these incidents, of which there's been many reports over the last couple of years, they're clearly saying this ain't any of our technology. And so reading between the lines is very much definitely ET. But the fact that they admitted these things were real meant that for 70 years, people had been lied to, because the characteristics displayed now by these objects that had been caught on infrared aircraft radar and FLIR radar had been documented for 70 years. Nothing new.
Yeah.
But finally, they admitted that these things are real. And that's a massive thing that they can never retract.
Well, and also now we've got all the social media, and I mean, there's so many. I mean, I get so many people telling me about sightings and experiences and abductions now that you can't stop it now.
Well, yes and no. I think when you're dealing with the abduction phenomena, because the mainstream have kind of pigeonholed it into the world of where people are crazy, yeah, to the mainstream, then that's how they damage limitation. Is they've tried to kind of say it's all sleep paralysis, there's nothing to this, it's just people who are easily suggestible. But the reality is nothing further from the case. For example, Professor John Mack, who was a Harvard professor, he was one of the world's foremost psychologists, and he basically became aware of this in the early 90s. He did a research program thinking it was just some kind of mass hypnosis, some mass psychosis taking place. But he, after 6 months, had to conclude, having interviewed about 50 people, that they were describing real events. And he went public. And because he went public, and because he was a Harvard professor, he had attracted a lot of media attention. And because of that, they tried to get him sacked from Harvard. So there were repercussions for him, because anybody giving credibility to the subject, and the abduction phenomena is real. Mm. Absolutely. Now, I initially, when I began the police database, was always very wary of abduction cases for that very reason, because it's hard to prove. But one of the first cases that I got involved in investigating was that of a former police officer called Alan Godfrey, who is a very famous, Britain's first recognised abduction victim, for want of a word. Ironically, from November 1980. And he only lived 40 miles away from where I lived. So when I started the database in 2002, he was only 40 miles away. He could have been 500 miles away, but he's on my doorstep. So yeah. I got to know him very well, and his case is well recorded over history. And he's been interviewed many times by TV, gone all around the world talking about his story. And he was the person that kind of convinced me that these things are real, because I was an advanced interviewer of suspects and witnesses. I kind of had a good idea of psychology and what makes people tick. And as a police officer, do tend to develop a sixth sense of whether somebody's telling you the truth or not. And I found Alan very, very credible. And so that was the case on abduction that convinced me that it was real.
Yeah.
And they say that it's millions all around the world. And unfortunately, the mainstream media, because they want to make this subject Looney Tune, they downplay it and pigeonhole you. I've been on live TV on national media, and I'm introduced with all that kind of stuff. They have to do anything they can to try to make you look a bit less credible than you are. It was obviously a lot harder for them to do that with me, because I was often going on telly as a still serving detective. It's hard to really detective. Ironically, I once did was on This Morning program twice with Holly Willoughby, and I gave some evidence about the Rendlesham Forest incident, and there were two heated debates that were filmed a couple of months apart, and they tried desperately to script it all, to put my arm up my back, to say, you'll say this, he will say that. And I knew that it was live TV and there was nothing they could do. So I was deliberately surly. I'd put various little things around, photographs, coins in my pocket to illustrate certain points. And they kind of didn't like me for going off script. But I knew that one arm would be tied behind my back. And to get the truth out there, you have to take risks. And so if you ever put my name into Google and look for YouTube and This Morning, Gary Hesseltine, you'll see these two debates, and they're very heated debates. But I'm nothing like that in reality. I'm very softly spoken, like we are talking now.
Yeah.
But for those two shows, I went in with a strategy, which was, I'm only going to have a few seconds before somebody cuts me off in the earpiece. Mm. So I've got to grab the attention while I can. And so the first time I went on, I was deliberately surly and argumentative. And my plan was to be surly, argumentative, grab the time and issue them a challenge. Let me show you as a detective the evidence, and they fell for it. And so it was like a heated argument. They're going, oh, what do we do now? Oh, we'll have you back. Yeah. And then they said that between the two shows, we'll have you back and we'll discuss five cases. You present five cases and we'll cover them. And I said, okay. By the time of the show, it was reduced to one. And by the time of the show, they wanted it all scripted. And that's why I say that I knew, even the second time that I was on, that, that one arm is tied behind the back. They do not want you to reveal anything to the British public that is not in the script, as it were. And that is the censorship that we have over this subject. Hopefully the Pentagon admissions will make that much harder for them to do. But I think that in the UK, in the, well, for, in America, for instance, there is massive news interview coverage. So instead of being silly, it's not real. Now they're talking about, where are these things from? These things are real. Where are these things from? The debate has changed. But in the UK yet, there's been no national TV coverage about what's happening in America. Hopefully, Capel Green, the documentary I'm involved in, will help change that in the UK.
Yeah, I hope so too. But I do think that people are more open to it now than ever before. I couldn't I couldn't have done this podcast 10 years ago.
Absolutely. You'd have been you'd have been marginalised, and people would said, "Don't be silly.
Joe's mad."
But all credit to you, Joe, for doing that, because obviously you are a very high profile person in your own right. And so it's good when the likes of Robbie Williams, the likes of Dan Aykroyd, who support the subject. And no doubt I'd be very surprised if privately, since you've begun the podcast, that a lot of people privately, one to one, perhaps other celebrities have come to you and said, well, actually, I've had something, but I've never told anybody.
Yeah, we have found people have, lots of people have said, I've never told this story before, I've never said this. You know, they open up and tell their stories. And I believe each and every one of them, I really do.
Well, you can quickly work out whether somebody is being sincere, especially if you know these people well.
Yeah.
You know the kind of people, what they are, their personalities. And then when they suddenly one-to-one say, well, actually, I've never told anybody this, but I had this strange experience. That's happened to me literally thousands of times since 2002 when I went public. And I'm always amazed by their sincerity. Very rarely do I get the impression that these people are just making it up to flatter me or to engage me in a conversation.
I've yet to meet somebody I've thought, oh, they're talking a lot of rubbish. I just haven't. You know, I believe when you open up like that and tell your story, that it's absolutely true. And I think people find that, you know, if you're talking to somebody that also has that experience, they feel more comfortable to open up.
The key thing, and I found this with police officers, there's two reasons why people don't come forward, especially if you're a professional person. One is the fear of ridicule, and two is a perceived risk to your career. Yeah. Which is very, very real, as I found out to my cost later on. But that's the reality. That's why pilots don't come forward very often, especially if it's a lone sighting where there is no corroboration from another pilot. Yeah. They'll keep it to themselves because they dare risk being grounded by saying, well, actually, I saw something really strange. You know, they just won't take that risk. But more and more people are beginning to come forward, and the Pentagon admissions, I keep saying that, are helping to change that because it's moving the debate forward. And really, we've been stuck for about 50 years without moving forward.
Well, let's hope it all sort of starts to get more normal. Yeah.
I hope so, because I think that, like you say, people are, we now live in an era where people kind of live by social media. Mm. People can't remember an era without a phone. Technology is moving at a pace. They play computer games with, you know, in aliens all the time in make-believe. Yeah. I really don't think the world would be that frightened now. And I think with everything that we now know in astronomy through the Hubble telescope and all the exoplanets that have been discovered, I think people will accept it. Yes, there will be a reaction, but I think one of the reactions that the Americans who control the subject are frightened of is there will be a backlash once the public realise that you've been lied to for 70 years. And I think that is actually one of the reasons that's keeping it back.
Yeah, and of course, how can we possibly think that we're alone in this wide, wide universe? It's just absolutely not so.
Well, I'm not a mathematician or a physicist, but I cannot even imagine just a billion planets, let alone they say in our galaxy, Milky Way, there's something like 100,000 million planets that are capable of sustaining life. Well, I can't even get my head around that. It's just too big a number. So when you extrapolate it with what we know of the known universe and its size, it's infinitesimal. And we get into this silly debate of where astronomers now, who refuse to, a lot of astronomers just refuse to look at the best pilot cases, et cetera, et cetera. They still have got their heads stuck in the mud. They will say, oh, well, the distances involved, blah, blah, blah. But I've never understood that argument, because if a civilization on another planet developed just 1,000 years ahead of Earth time, would they be flying around in jet-propelled aircraft?
No, of course not.
Of course they wouldn't. They'd have 1,000 years of technology. Yeah. Well, look where we've just gone in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, with the smartphone technology. It's running at a pace. So it's really is the Star Trek of the future. It becomes the Star, you know, becomes fact, science fact. And people have got many scientists have got a very narrow field of view on this, a very narrow mind on this. Yeah. And they really should open their minds to say, well, look, we can't dismiss these pilot reports. You know, especially when they're corroborated with video, radar, multiple radar, multiple aircraft testimony, witnesses, ground radar, ground witnesses. It's ridiculous for them. They have to explain those away, and they can't. They just simply don't talk about them.
Gary, I've absolutely enjoyed so much talking to you today. Thank you so much. That's our show for today. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please rate us on whatever platform you get your podcast from. It helps people like you find us. Today's show was produced by Mike Hansen for Pod People Productions. Theme music by Mike Hansen and Jamie Allen. Special thanks to Nigel Heath and our narrator, Mike Hansen Sr. If you want to share your stories, we'd love to hear from you. Just email info@podpeopleproductions.co.uk. Subject matter, alienation. Beam me up next time. I'm Jo Wood. And I believe.
Pod People.